From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Dick Miller got his start in Hollywood, acting in Roger Corman's low-budget quickies like Bucket of Blood and Little Shop of Horrors. He made such an impression on would-be directors like Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, and Joe Dante that they grew up to cast him in their own films. A talk with Dick Miller on today's Fresh Air. Also, we meet Michael Almereyda, the director of a new film about an eccentric family that stars two eccentric actors, Crispin Glover and Harry Dean Stanton. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews an album by one of the fathers of punk, Iggy Pop. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Presumed Innocent, starring Harrison Ford, based on the best-selling novel by Scott Turow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Diplomatic sources in the Persian Gulf say that Iraq appears to be scaling back its propaganda and military threats against Kuwait. The two sides are to begin talks this weekend aimed at ending disputes over land rights and oil prices. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has been attempting to mediate the dispute, which centers on ownership of a major oil field that straddles the border. There was tight security in West Germany for the convoy of American chemical weapons, the first of 30 that will be needed to complete the withdrawal of the weapons from the country. Thousands of nerve gas shells were taken from the American base at Clausen on the first stage of the journey to the South Pacific, where they'll be destroyed. The BBC's Matt Fry has this report.
Local villagers watched passively as 20 containers of sarin and VX nerve gas, enough to wipe out the population of Europe, rolled past them in a creeping convoy of 80 vehicles. Over 1,500 policemen cordoned off the country roads as the trucks, accompanied by ambulances, sharpshooters and helicopters hovering above, snaked through the remote forests on the Luxembourg border to a depot 35 miles away. The operation, which lasted 2.5 hours, will have to be repeated 29 times before all the 100,000 shells of nerve gas are assembled at the Miesau depot. From here, they'll be taken by train to a northern German port in September and then shipped to the Johnston Atoll, south of Hawaii, for destruction. Unimpressed by the massive security precautions, local citizens groups and environmentalists tried unsuccessfully to get today's transport stopped.
The BBC's Matt Fry reporting from Bonn. Defense attorneys for Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry are close to resting their case. NPR's Scott Simon reports.
The mayor and his attorneys are calculating the doubts they've raised about the particulars of the government's charges that Marion Barry bought and used drugs will weigh for more than any skepticism jurors may have about a defendant who won't testify before them. Mr. Barry's defense attorney, R. Kenneth Munday, spent most of the day hammering away at the FBI agent who ran the operation that resulted in the mayor's arrest. Why, Mr. Munday asked Agent Ronald Stern, when Mayor Barry said 7 times he did not want to use drugs but to have sex with Rashida Moore, wasn't the sting operation called off? Also, in a bench conference that could not be heard by the jury or in the courtroom, Mr. Munday pressed the argument that Mayor Barry's arrest was part of a campaign by federal agents against elected black officials, saying he'd been told by attorneys for some of the government's witnesses that Agent Stern had tried to set sting operations against Atlanta's Mayor Andrew Young, legislator Julian Bond, and unnamed office holders in Chicago, and that 6 other women who had relationships with Marion Barry had refused to be used in drug operations against him. This is Scott Simon at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 10 points today to close at 2,920.79. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Roger Corman first made his reputation as the king of the quick, cheap genre film. My guest Dick Miller was in dozens of those films, like A Bucket of Blood, Little Shop of Horrors, Sorority Girl, The Terror, The Trip, and War of the Satellites. Several of the directors who grew up watching Corman's movies or got their start working for him later paid homage to Miller by casting him in their films. Martin Scorsese gave him the part of a club owner in New York, New York. Miller had a small part in Jonathan Demme's Swing Shift. Joe Dante cast Miller in every one of his films, including The Howling, Gremlins, and Gremlins 2, where he plays the neighbor who comes to visit just as the gremlin invasion begins. Before he made films, Dick Miller lived in New York, where he was writing, producing, and directing for TV and theater. He went to Los Angeles, hoping to write screenplays, but he met Roger Corman, who offered him a role in a film.
He was doing his I believe, a second film, a picture called Apache Woman with Lloyd Bridges. And the guy who introduced me said, Dick's a writer. You need any scripts? He says, I got plenty of writers. I don't need any scripts. I need actors. I said, I'm an actor. He said, okay, I'll stick you in a movie. I played an Indian in my first picture. And about halfway through, he asked me, he said, would you like to play a cowboy? I said, you're doing another movie already? He says, no, in the same movie. And I said, you're kidding. He said, no. He said, come back next week, you'll play a cowboy in town. So I wound up playing a cowboy and an Indian in my first movie. And darn near came close to shooting myself in the final shootout scene at the end.
Did anybody in the audience notice that it was the same person who was a cowboy and an Indian?
I don't think so, since it was so early. I mean, there was nothing to recognize. Nobody could say, oh, I've seen him before. A lot of dark makeup and some nose plugs. And the difference was, you could tell, that if you look close, if somebody said, that's the same guy, you'd say, oh, of course it is. But I don't think anybody was looking that close.
Did you have to learn how to ride a horse for the movie?
Oh, yeah, the old Hollywood story. Can you ride? Yes, you know. Can you jump out of an airplane? Sure. without a parachute? Of course. You know, they ask you all kinds of things, and you got to lie and say, of course I can do that. I had ridden a little up to that point, horses in stables in Central Park and places like that, and dude ranches, but nothing like cowboys and Indians. And I just figured, I've seen it done, I can do it. And that's pretty much how I learned. I learned on the first picture.
You played the lead in the 1959 Roger Corman movie, Bucket of Blood, and this has become a real cult classic. It was the leading role. You were a waiter in a beatnik coffee house, and you become an artist by covering first your dead cat in clay, and then by killing people and covering the corpses in clay and passing it off as sculpture. And once this artist becomes really acclaimed, you also become quite the hipster. Was it fun to spoof the hipster in the movie?
Well, it was made at the height of the coffee shop era. Everybody was going in for espresso.
You mean the coffee house, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the basic idea behind the picture, was the hipster coffee house groupies at that time, and the people who hung around, and the no talents and the talents of that era. And I think later on, Roger Corman made a picture called The Trip about the first, you know, big psychedelic outings that were going on, which was a little more serious. But it was also meant to cover that genre of what was happening at the moment. I love making Bucket of Blood. I think it still stands as my favorite picture.
The movie was shot in, I think, 5 days. Can you give us an idea of how you made a movie that quickly?
Well, 5 days was not as tight as it seemed. They were making TV half-hour shows in 2.5 days then. And people who had that down had that type of, that was a finger snap.
Right.
People who had that down at that moment could make movies that fast. When I started with Roger, we were making Westerns, and we would make them in 6 days. And that seemed like a fair amount of time. And later on, we got an extra day, a seventh day or an eighth day, and I thought, this is great, what a luxury. So by the time we got around to making a Bucket of Blood, 5 days was kind of a press, but most of the picture was shot in two sets, so it wasn't that much of a push. It's a matter of learning the technique. I think later on, when he made the famous Little Shop of Horrors, which was supposed to have been made in 2 days, and actually 2 days and a couple of spare nights, that also wasn't too much of a push. The people who were involved in it seemed to think, well, 2 days, okay, we'll try it, and if it doesn't work, we'll add another day.
But I understand you were offered the lead in Little Shop of Horrors, but you turned it down. Why didn't you take it?
I have a track record of turning down a lot of pictures for a lot of unknown reasons, even to myself. I think at that time, and I was hungry in those days, I would turn down jobs and say, I don't want to do it. I turned down Little Shop of Horrors because I had just finished doing Bucket of Blood, and I thought I was being asked to do the same character again. This was before they had sequels. If I had known it was going to be a sequel or a sequel character, I probably would have done it and been very happy. I kind of regretted it over the years. I turned it down kind of on an artistic level. I said, I've done this part. I don't want to do it again. Give it to somebody else. Give it to Jonathan, who was a very close personal friend of mine at the time. And I felt, give him the shot, I don't care. I said, I'll do anything in it.
Well, the role you did end up playing in Little Shop of Horrors was someone who's always hanging out in the flower shop eating the flowers. You were the plant-eating person instead of the
Yes.
Instead of the man-eating plant. and for people who don't know the story, it's the story of a guy who creates this plant, and the plant eats, the plant thrives on blood, so he's always killing people to feed the plant. So did you actually eat carnations for your role?
Yeah, they suggested that this was the character who was going to do this, and I thought, okay, fine, I'll take a bite. When you say cut, I'm going to spit it out and get rid of it. And the only drawback was that the carnations, I'm sure, Roger didn't go out and buy the freshest flowers. I don't know where he got them. They were kind of stale and old, and they were probably full of pesticides. But once I got them in my mouth, they didn't taste so bad. So I figured I'll chew them up and I'll see what happens. And it worked out fine. I actually became a flower eater from that picture.
You became a flower eater?
I've been known to steal centerpieces at weddings and things like that and take them home and eat them.
Seriously?
Oh, yes.
You're not pulling my leg on this?
No, I like flowers. If I get a chance, it's not a constant thing. Don't think it's a way of life with me. I go around eating flowers all the time. But I'll find myself maybe once a year or twice a year eating a rose or something that tastes good.
Huh. You know, Roger Corman says that Bucket of Blood and Little Shop of Horrors were a part of a new genre that he felt he was creating, the black comedy horror film. And I was wondering if you felt that all the actors had a good sense of humor, the kind of sense of humor that would get all of what was happening in the movie, you know, and enjoy the jokes.
I think at the time he was making those films, Roger didn't have the greatest sense of humor. I have to be honest about that. He wasn't quite sure that Bucket of Blood was going to be a comedy. He thought it was kind of a very serious thriller at the time. That's the truth. And all the people involved with him at the time had great senses of humor. I mean, it was not uncommon for us on location shots to play what you would call dirty tricks on Roger, because he didn't quite catch on to what we were doing at the time. But I'm not saying that he was ignorant of the fact that it was going to be a comedy. I think about halfway through he got the idea that this is funny. You know, these people are funny. And when he finished it, he said, "We've got to make another one." This is how Little Shop of Horrors came about. He says, "This is funny. We must make another picture just like it."
Give me an example of the kind of dirty trick that the actors would play on Corman.
It wasn't really a group thing. It was, I think it was more Jonathan Hayes and myself. We had an expression, "Show me what you mean." He would say, we were out in Hawaii shooting a picture. He said, "Run out there to the end of the coral and look around and then come running back." And we'd say, "Show us what you mean, Roger." And he'd run out there and come back and his feet would be bloody through his sneakers. I mean, it was just the coral would cut him up something awful. Or he would say, leap over this ditch, grab those bushes and pull yourself into the cane field. Well, we were told, never touch the cane, the sugar cane. It's got these little burrs on it. And somebody would say, "Show us what you mean, Roger." He'd jump, he'd grab the bushes, and we'd take out an hour while somebody washed his hands out.
Well, did he expect you to do it after he proved that this was a really dangerous and impossible thing to do?
Yes, and we'd do it. I mean, once it was shown to us, we said, okay, fine, you know. But we usually took more precautions than he had taken.
Actor Dick Miller is my guest. How come you stayed with Roger Corman for so long, and how long was it?
Let's see. When I went to work for Roger, I was not that serious about my career. I still didn't know if I wanted to be a writer, although I had stopped writing the minute I worked in as an actor in movies. I just said, this is kind of nice. I found it very easy to work for him. He was doing a lot of work, and I mean as many as 5 or 6 films a year, which is unheard of. The studios, you know, major studios barely turn out that kind of product. So I stayed with Roger 5 or 6 years and wound up doing about 35 films for him in that period. The work was easy. It was constant. I didn't have to look for jobs, which is the most difficult part of being an actor, I think. Mm-hmm. And I found myself every couple of months, I'd get a call from him and say, "We're going to do another picture, and we got a nice part for you." And as the roles got better, it became easier and easier to stay in that position.
Did he always write a role for you?
He didn't write a role for me. I will always be grateful to Roger for the fact that he didn't write roles for me. He let me do almost any part that came up. I think the opening picture was kind of the sign of which way we were going. I played a cowboy and an Indian. Well, you're not going to typecast me that way. You know? You're not going to say this guy does cowboys only or Indians only. I suddenly found myself playing rocket scientists, demented busboys, leading men, villains, everything. And he never said, you can't do that part. You know, he'd say, can you do this? Can you do that? I said, I can do anything. And I found myself in 35 pictures playing practically 35 different roles. I don't think many actors get that kind of opportunity.
How soon did you try to establish your career away from Corman?
I think that happened. It's a stage of life you go through. It's more than a career change. After so many years, I started to put on a little weight and get a little heavy, and was entering middle age, and there wasn't that much work around for me. He said, "You want to play truck drivers or redneck sheriffs?" So it seemed like I was not getting the work I wanted, and by that time, I had established a fairly good name in the business, and that was the first time I really started to move out and see if I could work for other people. I don't say it was a fallow period, but there wasn't that much work, and then suddenly it started again. I guess I lost weight, I changed my image, I built up some muscles, and I started a new career again.
Mm-hmm. So when you changed your image and you started again, what kind of roles did you get?
Now it was pretty definite that I was not going to be doing too many leading roles. Because again, the age group was different, and you don't find yourself doing that many parts. I was playing gangsters and cops. I was doing the same thing I had done before, only in smaller parts. And then things would come up like Heart Like a Wheel, and then The Howling. I had met Joe Dante. I think that was probably the big change in my career. And we got along pretty good, and he asked me to do something in Hollywood, Hollywood Boulevard. And it turned out to be one of my favorite parts. I just love the scenes. It wasn't a big part, but it seemed to be very outstanding when it was all done. And based on that, I went to work doing a lot more pictures in that genre, the new horror films and the films of that nature.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is actor Dick Miller. This is Fresh Air. Actor Dick Miller is my guest, and he's performed in dozens of Roger Corman films, including Little Shop of Horrors and Bucket of Blood. He's appeared in every one of Joe Dante's movies, including Gremlins 2. He's been in New York, The Terminator. For a couple of years, he was on the Fame television series. He's made many, many movies over the years. Well, Joe Dante has cast you in every one of the movies that he's made. And I think that a lot of the people who became well-known directors after working for Roger Corman ended up casting you in their films. Joe Dante is an example. Alan Arkush, you were in his Rock and Roll High School. Help me out with this. What are some other examples?
Marty Scorsese.
Yeah, New York, New York. You played a club owner.
Jonathan Demme, Jonathan Kaplan.
Mm-hmm. Were you self-conscious
Steven
about
Spielberg,
this?
Oh, really? Not to overlook Steven.
Were you self-conscious about this, knowing that people were paying homage to you in a way? I mean, they'd seen you in all these movies. Do you know what I mean? And your parts were, in a way, an homage to yourself.
I was flattered, and I think probably Scorsese was the first one who summed it up for me when he was doing New York, New York. I went to see him, and I said, "What do you want me to read?" And he says, "I've been watching you since I'm 13 years old. You don't have to read for me, you know." He says, "You got the part. Bobby De Niro's going to come in here, and we'll try some ad-libs and see how you got that feeling with each other," which we did. And that was it. And I suddenly realized there were a lot of guys out there who started watching me when they were young teenagers and spent 10, 15 years watching me. And now they're grown up and they're producing and directing and writing and they want to use me. And I really was flattered. It took a while for it to reach me, but once it did, I was truly flattered.
You know, after working on all these quickie movies, like cheap quickie movies. What was it like, for instance, to work with Martin Scorsese on New York, New York, playing in a scene with Robert De Niro, and he's so famous for spending a really long time intensely getting into his character. And I'm sure it's, in a way, the opposite approach that actors had to take in the quickie Corman films, where you've got 2 days to shoot the whole movie.
Well, Bobby De Niro, actually, well, he started with Roger. He's also from that school.
Oh, I didn't realize he'd started with him, too.
Along with Nicholson. And if you put these guys to the test, you'll find out that they all know how to work fast. When the luxury of time came their way, then they started to use it. But basically, De Niro was right on top of, you know, let's shoot quick, let's get it done, let's get it over. Except his particular style is to stretch it out and ad-lib and see how long he can make the scenes and everything. I've worked with a lot of people, and those who come from that background all seem to be able to do that. It's not a big thing. Today, the school of doing that is probably the soaps. They get to work in soaps, and they have to learn a script in one day and go in and do it. So I think the background of most actors somewhere along the line, if they've had any experience at all, covers that type of fast work, rapid work. There are people who get into the business, they get in lucky, young kids, and they really don't have any background at all. They're looking to establish a mood or create some inner feeling of some kind, but it's a lot of... I don't want to say it. It's a lot of unnecessary activity.
Actor Dick Miller is my guest. Let's talk a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
I'm from the Apple, New York. I grew up a combination of places there, Long Island, the Bronx, Manhattan. Did many, many things before I became an actor. I was always interested in show business, but I kind of saw myself as a singer and a musician. I played drums professionally for a while. I was with Bobby Sherwood, the big band leader, for a while, although I didn't work in his big band. I worked in small groups with him. And always kind of thought of myself that I would be a singer one day. I worked at that for a while professionally and really didn't care for it so much, to be singing for other people.
What kind of material did you sing?
Pops, kind of like Nat Cole and Frank Sinatra, that genre. I was just a pop singer. A lot of jazz, though. Mm-hmm. I love jazz, and that was the world I played in, played drums in the jazz world. And I like that kind of music. I remember taking a fling at acting when I was about 15 or 16 years old. A friend said, "Do you want a free summer vacation? All you have to do is paint some flats for me, and there's free food, free room, free girls, everything you want to spend your summer with." And I went up there and I painted flats for a while, and I was watching the acting, and I said, "I can do that." And he gave me a shot out. He says, "You're going to play a butler." And I had very few lines. I won't make this a long, boring story. I wound up forgetting every line. And I was going, and the other actor on stage who I was working with had been pre-warned, and he took all my lines, and he made him questions and said, "Yes, there's somebody here to see me. Do you want to show him in?" And yeah, he did all of that, and a big laugh for everybody. But by the end of the summer, I had turned out to be the company character actor, and I enjoyed it. But I didn't touch it again for 4 or 5 years.
Weren't you also a psychologist?
Yes, I'm a graduate psychologist. I went to... Columbia, and worked at that briefly, and decided I didn't want to be dealing with the crazy people. And then I came out to Hollywood, where everybody's nuts, and it served me a good standing. I thought at one time I would do that. I come from a family of professionals, mostly lawyers. I have my kid brother is a Supreme Court justice in New York State, and my older brother was the coroner of Orange County and also an attorney, and my nephews. I'm probably the only non-attorney in my family. And I thought, well, I'll do something along those lines, but I didn't enjoy it. It's not that I didn't enjoy it, it's that I enjoyed the world of music and acting better, so I just kind of drifted into it.
I'm wondering if any of the patients that you had during the brief time that you were a psychologist ended up seeing your movies like Bucket of Blood and wondering, this is the guy who is going to help me?
That would be very funny. I don't know. Most of the people I was dealing with were I worked at Bellevue for a while, and the cases that came in there, like, they wouldn't have recognized me the next morning.
What are your ambitions now? What kinds of roles would you like to be doing?
That's hard to tell. I somehow don't see myself as getting older. I keep looking to see if when my hair's going to turn gray or when I'm going to get back the pot belly I had when I was in my 40s. It's not there. I look pretty good. And I just keep thinking, what is there around for me? You know, there isn't too many parts for older guys. You hit a certain age and it stops. You're not a leading man, and you're not the competition for the leading man. You're almost too old to play the fathers and the police chiefs, and you know, it creeps up on you. I don't know. I'd probably like to play somebody's grandfather who's very rough and tough, and either as an ex private eye or an ex cowboy or an ex seaman or something. Pretty much, I'd like to play myself. That's what I've been doing for 35 years.
What was your reaction when you saw people who you were working with become famous, like Jack Nicholson, who had one of his first roles in Little Shop of Horrors?
Well, see, now that's supposed to be the questions that hurt and really get in deep, but they don't. Jack and I were personal friends for a lot of years, almost from the time he started making movies. We became buddies, and the relationship stayed that way until he became a huge star, because there is a difference in lifestyles. It's not like your friend is making a quarter of a million or a half a million or even $1 million a year. That you can cope with. He's living a little better than you. But when a guy's making $10 million and $20 million, and I believe he made about $50 or $60 million on his last picture, it becomes almost impossible to maintain a relationship, a personal relationship, because you're either a part of the entourage or, you know, you cease to be a friend. You cease to be part. You become part of the group. So we drifted away from each other. When we see each other, we're friendly, and I think there's probably a great deal of respect for each other there. But as these guys made it, I try to figure out what is it that they have that I don't have. Why is it that the bright teeth or the straight nose or the whatever it is that makes them a star? What got them the edge? I didn't feel bad. I always figured this could still happen to me. Even now, I figure I could still get lucky. Something could come along, and I could get lucky and suddenly become hot. You don't have to be a leading man. You could be a John Goodman. You know, you could be a character actor that gets lucky. Something comes along in your career. But basically, if you understand that it is fate, maybe not even that, it's luck. It's luck and not necessarily talent. You can live with it, because that luck could be yours too.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
My guest has been actor Dick Miller, and he's currently appearing in Gremlins 2, directed by Joe Dante, and he's been in all of Joe Dante's films, lots of Roger Corman movies, and lots of other movies as well, including New York, New York, and Terminator, Rock and Roll High School, and a lot of these movies are now out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actor Nicolas Cage, and he's starring in the new David Lynch movie, Wild at Heart. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, from proto-punk to post-punk, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Iggy Pop's new record. The 1939 movie Wizard of Oz gave us a lasting image of what life must be like in Kansas. But now film director Michael Almereyda has fashioned another kind of Kansas in his first feature film, Twister, where the chaos in one eccentric family's home matches the chaos of the storm raging outside. Coming up, Almereyda tells us about directing Crispin Glover and Harry Dean Stanton. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Presumed Innocent, based on the best-selling novel by Scott Turow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. South African President F.W. de Klerk has held an urgent meeting with Nelson Mandela, Deputy President of the African National Congress, to talk about the alleged infiltration of ANC insurgents in South Africa. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Since Saturday, the government has been leaking reports to the press saying that the ANC is continuing to infiltrate insurgents into the country despite the ongoing peace negotiations. The police have also arrested at least 40 ANC members. The latest was Mac Maharaj, a senior member of the ANC's National Executive Committee. The ANC responded by demanding their immediate release. And today, President de Klerk issued a statement saying that the ANC doesn't fully appreciate the seriousness of the situation. Meanwhile, Mandela has announced a major concession. He's dropping his demands for a range of laws to be repealed before he agrees to suspend violence. He now says the ANC will suspend hostilities as soon as political prisoners are released and exiles allowed to return home. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
In Philadelphia, General Electric has been fined $10 million for defrauding the federal government on a contract to supply combat computer systems and agreed to pay $20 million to settle other civil matters. The $10 million fine imposed on the big company was the second largest ever imposed on a U.S. defense contractor. The Federal Centers for Disease Control reports today that a woman apparently became infected with the AIDS virus after having a tooth pulled by her dentist. The dentist was infected with the virus. NPR's Patricia Naiman has more.
The woman was diagnosed with AIDS-related pneumonia about 2 years after she had her tooth pulled. Federal officials say interviews with the woman indicate she was not at risk for getting AIDS. She had not used IV drugs. Her two boyfriends were tested for the disease and both were negative. The woman said the dentist wore protective gloves and a mask. Federal health officials say infection probably resulted from a minor accident during the tooth extraction or when an instrument tainted with the dentist's blood was used. The CDC is now reviewing its recommendations for AIDS prevention for medical personnel who practice invasive procedures, but health officials say the risk of getting AIDS from an infected dentist or doctor is still very small. This is the first case that's been reported to federal health officials. This is Patricia Naimond reporting.
Soviet leader Gorbachev says that his country needs financial aid now from the West in order to save his economic reform package. The Soviet leader says financial help would give him room to maneuver as he tries to get the Soviet economy to a market-based distribution of goods. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 10 points to close at 2,920.70, volume 155 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, the director of a new offbeat film that stars Harry Dean Stanton and Crispin Glover. But first, Iggy Pop has a reputation for being one of the bad boys of rock and roll. But rock critic Ken Tucker says Pop's new album, Brick by Brick, reveals new dimensions.
I want your hide, man, so don't trip me up. Shake your leg like the tail of a pup. I'm paying dues till I register heat. Sure hope I don't end up on the street. Homeboy, homeboy, everybody needs a home. Homeboy, homeboy, everybody needs a home.
Iggy Pop is one of those legendary wild men of rock and roll who's always been a lot smarter, a lot more thoughtful than his image would have you believe. He created his legend in the late 60s with his Detroit band, The Stooges. With them, Iggy created a kind of proto-punk rock, by yelling over minimal guitar chords and rolling around on stage in the glass of broken beer bottles. Since that time, Iggy has decided to make a career out of rock instead of a suicidal art statement. The result has been extremely uneven, but Brick by Brick is one of his stronger efforts.
I want to build a house where an ad don't scream. I want to live in peace, quietly. I want to have a place of love and safety. People ought to live how and where they want. People ought to have respect in front. People ought to get along pretty okay. So get off my dick. I'm building it brick by brick. Brick by brick.
Blunt, often full of vulgar language, Brick by Brick is, Iggy claims, a protest album. A record full of scorn and contempt for conventional lives, like maybe yours and mine. This would, of course, be utterly insufferable if the music wasn't so fitfully good. The artwork on the cover of Brick by Brick is a nightmarish scene by the cartoonist Charles Burns. Burns does the Dog Boy comic strip for a number of alternative newspapers around the country. It's about a man who behaves like a dog. I don't think it's a coincidence that Burns has provided the cover for a guy who used to wear a dog collar on stage and has recorded songs called Dog Food and I Wanna Be Your Dog. Cartoonish notions of animalistic behavior, of submission contrasted with snarling rebellion, are a big part of what Iggy Pop is all about.
I'm sliding like a lizard on my belly and back. It's a miracle I haven't fallen through any cracks. The life on display.
There's a lot of Iggy thrashing around and yelling on this record, but there are also a few quiet moments. In the past, his ballads have tended to be terribly overstated and hokey, as if he was embarrassed to be revealing this side of himself. On this album's Moonlight Lady, however, Iggy uses that wobbly baritone of his to create a lovely piece of music.
Who's gonna tell you goodnight? Who's gonna put out the light? I love you, and love is almost crazy. Slipping through the so-and-so, over all the fields we go. Moonlight Lady.
Iggy has always attracted big names, mainstream artists who admire the risks he's taken, and who want to help him cross over to the big time. A decade ago, David Bowie produced and co-wrote two albums in a row with Iggy, The Idiot and Lust for Life, both wonderfully tough yet witty records that didn't sell well. This time around, Iggy's producer is Don Was, who just helped Bonnie Raitt get into the top 10 for the first time in her life. Four cuts on Brick by Brick feature two members of Guns N' Roses, the most popular hard rock act in the country. Guitarists Waddy Wachtel and David Lindley, usually to be heard backing Linda Ronstadt and Jackson Browne, supply a few accessible riffs. And on Candy, Kate Pearson of the B-52s sings a spiraling duet with the old Iggster. He'll probably never have a big hit, but at least he's expanding his range.
I know, baby.
Iggy Pop's new album is Brick by Brick. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
I'm glad I am crazy. It keeps me trying. I despise the trendies. I know they're lying. If you want to stir up real mud, big guy.
This is Fresh Air. Twister is a new movie about a family of eccentrics in Kansas. A couple of the actors are as offbeat as the characters they play. Harry Dean Stanton stars as the father who made a fortune from miniature golf and soda pop. Crispin Glover plays his son. Twister is the first feature film by writer and director Michael Almereyda. It was backed by Vestron Pictures, but the movie was never distributed theatrically because Vestron folded. Twister was rescued last April through a screening at the Anthology Film Archives that brought good reviews in New York. It will open in Los Angeles August 8th. Almereyda adapted the film from the novel O by Mary Robison. I asked Almereyda what interested him in the book.
It's the whole canvas of the book. It's beautifully written. When I first read it, I just loved the book. The characters are very vivid. She writes wonderful dialogue. She writes in a very precise style that translates into images, I thought, in a really hard-edged, clear way.
Were there pictures you had in mind before you even started to make the movie?
Sure. I tend to work out of pictures and images and characters, and Mary really provides that.
What were some of those pictures you knew you wanted in the movie?
I think it's mainly the spectacle of a big house in the middle of nowhere, and a feeling of walls closing in on characters who are sort of desperate and passive at the same time, but mainly a feeling of landscape that's not necessarily in the book and not necessarily, for that matter, in the movie, but a feeling of being out in the middle of nowhere and being lost in America. The book, after all, is about commercial clutter invading people's lives and people trying to keep afloat in the midst of it. And she made that very concrete in the kinds of struggles that are going on between the characters. It's a family, after all.
You grew up in Kansas, where Twister is set. Do you feel like you're offering a different view of the Midwest than the ones you're used to seeing or reading in popular culture?
It's a very abstract place for people who don't live there, because the context for Kansas is the Wizard of Oz. And even in Kansas now, it's almost as if the state's traumatized by the Wizard of Oz. You go to the airport, and there's nothing but postcards and T-shirts that refer to the Wizard of Oz. The place, actually, I hadn't been back for a while, and I guess the main point is that you don't see much or hear much of Kansas in popular culture. It's become an abstraction, and so it seemed exciting and interesting to set a movie there.
One of the things that really surprises me about your movie Twister is how you managed to get some of the actors that you did, and I say that knowing that this is your first feature film. How did you get Crispin Glover cast in the movie?
Well, I had met Crispin on the set of River's Edge and really wrote the part for him and had known him for a while and always had him in mind for it. And Crispin, he's a remarkable actor, but at the time, and even still for that matter, it's not as if he's been in that many fancy movies. So it's not something to be astonished about, I don't think. And it's a good part, and it's wonderful for him. He's great in it.
He gives a fabulously mannered performance. Did you want that?
Yeah, well, when you hire Crispin Glover, you have an idea of what you're in for.
Right.
It's a kind of heightened realism, and it's very adventurous and very extreme, and it stretches the corners of the character. And he goes all out. He's very devoted and adventurous, and in a way, I knew what I was in for, and he delivered the goods.
So I saw this. Feeding branches from this tree into a huge, shredder.
You should have heard the noise.
Hope I didn't put too much nutmeg in this.
I tell you, I saw this petite waif in the rain feeding this fire-breathing dragon of a machine, and I was really touched.
Touched in the head.
Is he mannered when he's not acting?
I wouldn't say mannered. I hope his performance isn't really mannered so much as, I think there's a grain of emotional truth to it all the way through, so I'm a little uncomfortable with that word.
Yeah.
He's not Joe Normal, and he's never stranger than when he's trying really hard to be normal, but he can be a really nice guy, sure. He's a genuine eccentric. Everyone knows that, I guess.
Harry Dean Stanton, how did you cast him in the movie?
Well, it's kind of elementary. People were keen on the script, and as Harry Dean said, he felt blackmailed into doing it by the quality of the script, which was quite a compliment, mainly, I think, to Mary Robison, who, after all, provided the basis of it. And he read it and called instantly, and we met. In fact, I'd been working on a short film I wanted to do with him a few months before that, so I had known him a little bit. So it wasn't really that complicated. It was pretty simple.
I wonder what it's like as a more or less a newcomer to direct someone who's been working for a long time, like Harry Dean Stanton.
The movie was difficult to direct because there were a lot of people in tiny rooms, and it wouldn't really have mattered who those people were, and they were all remarkably talented, and part of what makes the movie special, I think, and I hope, is the nature of the ensemble, and that everyone in it is really good and really specific in what they do. The intention and the necessity was to develop a family on the set, and because the movie's about a family. So that sometimes everyone's nerves were very raw and it was traumatic and difficult, but in the finished movie, I think you feel people connecting or else missing each other in a way that's emotionally true, and I'm glad I got that.
Did you grow up in what you'd call a normal family? I ask that because this family is so eccentric.
And regardless to say, I didn't grow up in a family as loony as the Cleveland family in this movie. And neither did Mary Robison. It's just, it's a way of, it's like Crispin's performance. It's a way of heightening what's already out there and of making it a little more vivid and a little more immediate to deliver the feeling of reality.
A couple of American critics, I think, have made the comparison between your films and European films in the sense of it being more about character than about a narrative with a lot of events and a complicated plot.
I suppose that's a fair call, but it makes me uneasy because I feel unavoidably, hopelessly American and proud of it. And my subject matter, the characters, the places the movies are set are really emphatically American. There's a photographer I like called William Eggleston, who's quoted as saying somewhere that he says, "I'm at war with the obvious." And I feel on speaking terms with the obvious, but what interests me most in movies and in life isn't necessarily obvious. And sometimes you can only get at that by going at an oblique angle and concentrating more on character and on the things they do that aren't necessarily fed into a plot. But I feel pretty true blue American.
You have a short film that stars Dennis Hopper. I think it was a student film, is that right?
No, it was just I scrambled some money together and it's in effect a student film, but I wasn't going to school anywhere.
How did you manage to work with Dennis Hopper? He's so hard to get access to.
Is he? Have you been trying?
Well, we've been trying to get him for an interview for a couple of years and have been striking out.
Gee whiz. Well, I at the time, this is 5 years back, you know, he was on the comeback trail. And that year he did about 11 or 12 movies. And he was wonderful. He worked for free. He was a saint. He just happened to like the script and he came in and did it. And I think he was in a different, well, obviously, it was a different situation than he is in now. But he couldn't have been more gracious, and I thought he was pretty heroic about it.
So when you're sending a script to an actor who you want to be in a film,
yep.
Do you have to send it to their agent, or is there a way to get it directly to them? Because I should think, you know, a script by someone who's not well-known yet is the kind of thing an agent might screen out, thinking that they're really helping the actor that they represent.
I try to steer clear of agents in general, because the most direct contact is, there's less confusion. Either I know people who know actors, or I might have met the actor somehow, and it's not that hard really to get to people, because actors, you have to remember, are not, most of the year they're not working. No matter how busy the actor is, they don't make that many movies a year. So I'm often astonished by how badly cast movies are, or how unimaginative the casting is, because there's nothing more crucial really, and there are tons of good actors out there. So I look forward to working with more great actors, but it somehow it's not that daunting to get to them.
Do you have another project in the works?
I've written a script about Amelia Earhart with a guy named Jim Robison, who's married to Mary, and I'd very much like to do that. I'm very excited about that. And otherwise, if I don't get money for that in a hurry, I think I'm just going to go backwards. And my first film was shot in 35mm. I think I'm going to do a feature in 8mm next, Super 8, and I'm writing a script for that. So starting big and getting small, or starting small, really, and getting smaller.
What would the idea be of going back to Super 8, doing something that you can fund yourself?
Yeah, and I like the extremity of it, and the stories about people scrounging around squatting in a tenement in the Lower East Side, and the rawness of it seems really appropriate.
Do you think that Twister is going to get released to a lot of other cities, or is it too soon to tell?
It's going to be in L.A. next month, and then Kansas. Where else?
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Almereyda directed the film Twister. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to have reports of what seems to be an agreement at OPEC in Geneva, which would favor Iraq. You know, Iraq has been threatening neighboring Kuwait with military action, in part, if they don't cut back production. And now it seems there will be an agreement that would force the Kuwaitis to heed OPEC quotas, and perhaps that might raise the price of oil. We'll also hear about the House of Representatives' action on Congressman Barney Frank. And Howard Berkus will have the concluding part of his report on the movement for a new West. So much has been in the West a matter of environmentalists on the one hand, developers on the other. This is a story about a movement toward a middle ground.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The best-selling novel, Presumed Innocent, has been made into a new movie, and it opens this weekend. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
3 years ago, when Scott Turow's novel, Presumed Innocent, was gobbled up by the movies for an unprecedented $1.25 million, it seemed an obvious blockbuster. It had murder, sex, politics, rich characters with tangled relationships, and a great courtroom plot in an era when courtroom dramas were suddenly back in style. But Hollywood didn't realize that Presumed Innocent was too much of a good thing. What kept you turning the pages was not the plot itself, but the wealth of authentic detail that propelled it. Strip away the detail, and all you've got is the sort of courtroom jiggery-pokery that Perry Mason might have dispatched in an afternoon. That's the problem with Alan Pakula's movie. There's nothing in it but the novel's plot. And while the film's two big looming questions, whodunit and what will the jury decide, are mildly engrossing, Pakula has directed the whole thing with such ponderous solemnity that Presumed Innocent comes off feeling top-heavy and faintly ridiculous. You keep wondering, why am I here? Where's the fun? Harrison Ford plays public prosecutor Rusty Savage, whose boss, played by Brian Dennehy, has just assigned him a tough case. Their ambitious young colleague, a sex bomb named Carolyn Polemus, has been murdered. And since both Ford and Dennehy have had affairs with her, along with practically every other attorney in the Midwest, it's a pretty dicey case. It gets dicier still when Savage is accused of the murder, and he has to hire a smooth attorney named Sandy Stern, played by Raul Julia, to save his neck.
Look, when I was a prosecutor, I always knew I had a winner when the defendant refused to testify. All I want to do is tell the truth. The jury wants to hear me say I didn't do it.
And that you will do very well. But with every word, you will confirm what the prosecution is saying, that you were overwhelmed with a sexual obsession that took a wrong turn into rage when she ended the affair. And you will have gone a long way to eliminating the jury's reasonable doubt.
There's an almost insoluble problem built into this movie. Since the filmmakers want to keep us guessing until the end whether Savage is guilty or not, they can't let us get too close to him. We can't ever really know what he's thinking. And that means that even though we're supposed to be squirming along with him, he feels utterly remote to us. All the more so because of Harrison Ford's weirdly interior performance. The way he grimaces and purses his lips and hangs his little head, well, something must be going on inside there, but what? And though it's awful to admit it, the more you're forced to look at Ford's breathtakingly ugly Julius Caesar haircut, the less you want to know what's ticking underneath it. Some of the other actors are better. Bonnie Bedelia, for instance, as Savage's long-suffering but oddly steely wife. Greta Scacchi, who radiates erotic heat as Carolyn Polemus. And Paul Winfield, whose jolly performance as the judge would look hammy in any other movie, but comes as a relief in one as somber as this one. Alan Pakula has never been a very inspired director, but he's been able to create a kind of on-screen claustrophobia in movies like Clute and All the President's Men that tightened the tension like a winch. Here the tension is misdirected. It's not the character who's panting to escape. It's the audience.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Orji Voblaitis. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Nicolas Cage tells us about starring in David Lynch's new movie, Wild at Heart. And we meet Bruno Kirby, who's now co-starring with Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick in The Freshman. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.